Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil on the ones and twos. Should I introduce ourselves as at J. Williams Cincy alongside at Sharon Coolidge? Phil, I don't think Silent Phil has a Twitter feed. Yeah, he shrugs his shoulders.
I have been tweeting a lot lately. I don't know if anyone's noticed.
Special guest today, former federal prosecutor here in the Southern District, Ohio, David DeVillers, back. He's returning now to discuss what you and I are getting ready to discuss, and that is the P.G. Sittenfeld trial has come to an end.
I do want to say that I did reach out to Ken Parker, the U.S. attorney now. You know, these things are still going on. The householder case, not done. Jeff Pastor, not done. Like, you know, he doesn't really want to be on the hot seat. We'd have to ask him some questions. He'd have to say no. We'll ask. It's probably going to happen with, Attorney DeVillers too. But at least there's some distance in between him and what he's doing now and then. And so hopefully that we'll have Attorney Parker on at some point. But he really was like, not yet. Yeah. Which is understandable.
Understood. So we'll have Dave DeVillers here soon. But Sherry, we're 3 or 4 days removed from the verdict in the P.G. Sittenfeld trial. And for our audience, just sort of what's your big takeaway?
You know, I think, well, first of all, like describing what happened in that courtroom is like the number one thing that people have been asking me when I've been out and about, although I mostly slept this weekend. Just like the tension that was in that courtroom. And like, it's just the one thing I was never able to get through in stories. Like, you could describe it all you want. Plus, you're in a hurry when you're doing it. The way that the charges were written is that you had the two honest service wire frauds first, and you had two not guilties in a row. And everyone, that courtroom was packed. I think everyone in there was like, this is it. The two not guilties. And then this is going to happen. He's not going to be guilty. And then they said guilty. It honestly took a moment for everyone to process that the word guilty came out. And they did it very quickly. I've been at the reading of charges and everything. And I've never covered a federal trial start to finish like this. But, you know, where you've read the charges, they just read things really quick on this charge of bribery and this charge of attempted extortion. So it happened very, very quickly. And you just saw P.G. Sittenfeld like you've not seen him ever before, kind of like collapse forward in I'm sure shock, or I can't pretend to know what he was feeling. I haven't heard. I haven't talked to his attorney or anything. But you saw, you know, I don't think a lot of people thought that there was going to be a guilty finding in this.
Well, when you look at the statistics of the success rate of the federal government, it's kind of hard to not think that, the possibility of that's going to happen. But anyway, let's kind of look forward. And you have a story today on Cincinnati.com about what the sentencing could be, what it could look like. We, at the end of the day, we don't know yet, but give us a little kind of thought on what's coming out. When is the sentencing going to be? What kind of sentence could he get?
It is hard to imagine a prison sentence. He's going to prison. It's hard to imagine. And that's not to say he's not going to appeal. I don't know. I've reached out. We'll ask this question like every day. Are you going to appeal? We're watching for that. Like, certainly, you know, we haven't really heard like an answer from them. So I do want to make that clear. But I can't imagine a prison sentence that's certainly less than Tamaya Dennard. Like, that's the absolute floor, probably 18 months. I mean, things that are figured in to what's happening is, you know, a plea deal that's offered, a plea deal that's offered early. And it's a whole point system. I was like in math class, and we all know how I feel about that. I've mentioned that here before. It's this point system of like, you have this baseline points for the whatever the charges are based on the seriousness of them. But then there's just a lot of things factored in. And, you know, something that's not in today's story that kind of came back to me this morning is that she had so many things going into her favor that it really started out at like a level 24, but she just got so many points taken off for things in her life, you know, really taking responsibility in the court's eyes, that she ended up at like a level 17, which meant 18 months in prison. But things that are taken into account, the fact that they're in positions of public trust, the fact that this, whether they're taking the plea or not, I think there's going to be some time here. And no one knows. I promise you, as many people can ask me as many times as they want, nobody does know. Only the judge is going to know. But there's a lot of figuring, and that's going to take, I think, a lot of time.
Yeah. Well, you also had to factor in that Tamaya Dennard resigned, what it was within, what, 3 or 4 days, I think, from her counsel seat. Mm-hmm. PG never resigned from counsel. He took a suspension. So I think that probably helped her. Obviously, she agreed to a plea agreement. That helped her, right? I mean, she admitted her guilt. Mm-hmm. And then went and,
never. She had a lot of financial hardships. That was like a big thing that was mentioned in her sentencing. You never do see these sentencing reports, but the judge does talk about them a lot. So you kind of hear what's in them. And Tamaya, she had a difficult life growing up and overcame a lot of things. And she went to college and, got a degree. And the judge praised her for that, really overcoming a tougher childhood. And that played in her favor, too.
And then, went and served her time in prison, has not made any kind of, public statements or anything. It's just kind of now gone about her life. I understand she's now out of prison and is going about her life. So in terms of probably cooperating, that was a case where, I think I don't know if this is the right word or not, but it went about as smoothly as it probably could have, I think. The Sittenfeld case is a completely different one than that. So, you were looking though, and I think you said in your story, it could be up to 3 months before this sentencing hearing occurs, correct?
Yes.
Up to 90
days. And he's not in custody. It's not how it works. I mean, people are like, ask me, was he taken out in shackles? Like, no. Like, it's very civil. The federal system is very civil. I've had even federal prison described to me.
Well, it's not a violent
civil
crime.
Place than state prisons are in the state system, and a lot of like decorum. And so, he just went home with his wife. He's out. In fact, even on sentencing day, Tamaya didn't go right away. There's a lot of COVID issues for her, but even for then, there can be a certain trust that the person's actually going to turn themselves in and not, flee the country or whatever. And so I don't think that's something that we're ever really going to see here, but eventually we will see a sentence handed down.
Wow. I guess anything else you want to add here before we kind of jump over and bring Dave DeVillers on?
I would say, we didn't do a podcast last week. We just ran out of time. Yeah. I worked most nights till like 10 o'clock. I think the toughest thing was seeing people. It wasn't just covering like a court case, which I've done a million times, like over at least a state court. But to see people that we both know and talk to at various times every day of our lives, to sit on the stand was a very difficult thing to do. And it's the thing that I'm still processing, just people that we knew and now all the different things that we've heard. So I think that it was a different level of just being tired because I was covering a court case. It was emotionally draining seeing and hearing, people's voices and a lot of things I didn't know. And I always have said I probably know about 10%. Thank you, everyone, for reading my stories. I probably know like 10% of what's really going on as much as I try. I was really surprised by a lot of the things I heard. And not like surprised, like, okay, obviously we'd heard there's a culture of corruption, but I didn't know that, or I didn't know this, or, now I know. So I can tell you we heard a lot of asides. We heard a lot of asides, Jason, so I'm not done covering the trial. We're going to go back and, the asides matter when it comes to covering City Hall and revisit some of those things.
Justice was served and
Period. Maybe Attorney DeVillers will, give us some more scoop.
Yeah. Special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. Pleased to welcome back for a second time at Encore, former U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Ohio, David DeVillers. Dave, how you doing?
I'm well. How you guys doing?
Doing well. Well, I have no idea why we're having you back on the podcast.
Of course, we've already talked about this a little bit before we started chatting. Of course, but you know, I really something that resonated with me so much over the last few weeks is a phrase that you used at the very beginning of everything that we heard about what was happening at City Hall, which was there was a culture of corruption. And after, you know, the 2.5 weeks of trial, of all the things we heard, not just things about P.G. Sittenfeld, I thought, wow, that is like the best description ever. So anyway, I was like, I thought you'd be a good podcast guest today because that phrase is still really kind of just noodling around in my head.
Yeah, I don't think it was anything particularly profound based on what we were seeing. I think a lot of people would have come up with it, but I'll take the credit, I suppose, yes.
Can you kind of take us, I mean, you know what? Let's just start. How about your takeaway with what you saw at trial?
So to be perfectly honest, I didn't see much of it because I'm in Columbus and it wasn't heavily covered up here. I read, you know, what you and some other people were writing about what you were watching the trial. So, you know, I didn't hear a lot of the television news or radio news, mostly just print news, but, you know, not any huge surprises. I think, you know, it's a tough case, I think, for both sides. I mean, it's a bit different than other bribery cases in that, you know, you're talking about a situation where the allegations are strictly, to some extent, strictly that the bribe or the kickback was going directly into a campaign fund as opposed into someone's pockets or in some kind of money laundering mechanism. So, you know, that's a tough road to go down as a prosecutor, and it is a bit different than traditional kind of bribery cases.
But that money was just as important to him as his own campaign fund or his own money, to be honest. He was very proud of that account. He would go around bragging about it. And yes, he would say it was secret, but he was very proud to have it. And he was planning on using it to gain power. I don't feel like I'm speaking out of turn. And so I think this account, I mean, I know it's different, but when you get down to it, it really was the same. No matter where you put the money, it was still benefiting him. I think the prosecution proved that.
You're preaching to the choir on that issue, but at the same time, it's a different jury instruction. You know, they have to prove an explicit quid pro quo that, as opposed to an implicit quid pro quo. So that's one factor. And the other one is just how jurors see it, right? So jurors see kind of, they hear bribery. Often they think, all right, you know, some, you know, luxury condo in Cyprus is, you know, being used, benefiting some politician somewhere. So that's kind of the concept, you know, and you're right. You're right. This is extremely important. And it does go to like a cultural issue of what politicians and government officials feel is the culture, what is permissible. And the only way to really, you know, that line keeps getting more blurry and blurry and blurry. And no matter what the law says, no matter what the jury instructions are, until those cases are actually prosecuted and people are held accountable, it's going to keep going.
The night we got the jury instructions, they kind of were downloaded on Pacer. I printed them out, and Alex, my husband, walks by the bedroom, and I was going to bed earlier than normal because we had to get up early for the trial. And he's like, "What you reading?" I'm like, "Jury instructions." All 67 pages of them. And he's like, "Huh, oh, you should be asleep in a second." They were actually very interesting, though, and a blueprint of what that jury was going to see.
Yeah, the jury instructions are probably the most underrated, most important aspect of any trial. It's what you need to read long before you even indict the case, at least what you think they're going to be, let alone before you start the prosecution. But wait till you read a RICO jury instruction. You know, that's about 260 pages. So it's complicated, but I'm always amazed how jurors really do respond and follow those jury instructions. And they really do, you know, to the best that they can. But I think it's something that jurors tend to take very seriously.
What are the chances? Because I'm just going to shoot for the moon here. And you say when you can't answer a question, what are the chances that you're going to tell us how this all started? Because it started even earlier than we thought in 2018. And I'm really trying to, you know, get to the crux of what happened in 2017 to start everything.
There's 0% chance that I'm going to announce stuff. You know, you can ask Mr. Parker.
Yeah, yeah. He's not ready to talk.
But you know, that's up to him now.
Is that 0.0%?
Yeah, about that. But I mean, I think it's not one, you know, the idea of protecting kind of, I'll call them trade secrets of investigations, you know, kind of how we go about doing things is something that, you know, we try to keep pretty close to our vest. But then you got transparency. But in this case, you also have a situation where that investigation touched on other cases, yes. Right? Both that you're aware of too, you know, that have been indicted already, some that are still being under investigation. So it makes sense that not to get into that yet.
All right, fair enough. I will be at said subsequent trials. You know what I do? I have like a process question that a lot of people have asked me and I don't know the answer to. So I learned a lot about proffers during this trial because, of course, we've heard that Mr. Ndukwe has one and Mr. Camras has one. So if you have a proffer, then do the people get charged and the proffer is just helpful? I didn't read the proffers were immunity. Can you explain the process to me?
Yeah, proffers are not immunity. You know, proffers are not a promise not to prosecute. Proffers are a promise not to use the statement. That is what you're talking about against them. It's an off the record conversation, and it can be used for derivative use. That is, like, let's say I'm doing a proffer and I tell, you know, the agents where I hit a gun. They can go get the gun, but they can never use the fact that I told them where the gun was or that I had the gun against me in court. And unless I take the stand, if I take the stand, they can use it to impeach my credibility. So basically, it's an off the record conversation. And so often people, you know, sometimes it's because the defense attorneys, rightfully so, want to protect their client, even if they think they're not going to be charged or believe they're innocent. They'll ask for a proffer because of, you know, situations where they think that there might be at least some culpability or some possibility of interpretation of culpability. But most times, quite frankly, proffers are done after someone's charged. Often after someone's been indicted or charged or arrested, and they come in and they say, all right, look, I did this. These are the people who helped me out. These are my co-conspirators, or something completely tangential where, look, I know about a number of murders. I have nothing to do with that case, but, you know, the guy in the cell told me about it, or, you know, I witnessed it a number of years ago. Things of that nature are also proffers.
Do you anticipate, I mean, do you think that Mr. Ndukwe and Mr. Camras could be charged then? I mean, yeah, they did both
that's
say.
That's completely, I can, you know, and I think I made this clear when I talked back in the first, when I was, this first came out. Is that, you know, Mr. Ndukwe, there was a decision not to charge Mr. Ndukwe, I believe, even before he started cooperating in any serious way.
And the things he was talking about in what, at least the part of the proffer, did happen back in 2013.
That was a little bit
of time ago, even though sometimes City Hall time is very squints. It's either longer years or shorter years or like the trial, the whole, all my time covering City Hall kind of flashed before my eyes. Like, this is your life.
So at what point then are you kind of out of the woods, so to speak, in a proffer agreement? What do you do to like not get charged or?
So there's not getting charged. I would say is probably an exception to the rule. Although it happens a fair amount, but that's, you do what you promise to do. As long as you promise to cooperate with the government and testify, or whatever else there is, it could be restitution, it could be any other things, then you won't be prosecuted in return for your cooperation.
Gotcha.
That's not that unusual.
Can we, Sherry, do you have some more? I have a couple bigger picture questions.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. You know, obviously during the time you were the federal prosecutor, you know, we saw the arrests and the bribery charge of Larry Householder. We saw this PG. We saw Tamaya Denard, former councilwoman. Saw Jeff Pastor. Is this a bigger effort beyond the Southern District of Ohio to crack down on public corruption?
Yes, I think that's fair to say. I know that, you know, the Northern District had similar prosecutions in Toledo, while at the same time we were investigating, prosecuting.
That's right. Yep.
The Cincinnati officials. So the quick answer is yes. DOJ has probably the past 20 years kind of morphed into doing a lot of these state corruption cases. And quite frankly, the county prosecutors and the attorney general's office, they're concentrating on other things, right? They got particularly murder, death, kill, you know, drugs. They've got all sorts of things they got to deal with. And DOJ is kind of built to do that. Now that being said, the Supreme Court over the past, you know, 20 years has kind of pushed back on federal prosecutions using federal laws to prosecute state and local officials. And, you know, Bridgegate is one that comes to mind, and some other ones where, you know, they've kind of really tailored back the two statutes that we tend to use in state public corruption cases. So I think you're going to see a shift, quite frankly, to the states, and to the attorney generals of the states, to do a lot of these cases that the federal government really is not going to be able to do based on case law.
Huh. So, I guess the bigger thing is that there is a real concerted effort here, whether it's from the federal government or the state government, to root out, corruption in our local governments and our state government. And that's going to, yes, and what we're going to see, that's going to continue and continue to be aggressive.
Yes, it is. And that's one of the FBI's highest priorities. And so, you know, and by FBI, I also mean DOJ, right? So yeah. FBI is the investigating arm, but particularly for public corruption cases, it is very much a vertical prosecution concept where you and prosecutor and the agent meet from the day they open the case, you know, every day, and use the grand jury and other methods to go back in time and to proactively prosecute cases.
Did you bring in Nathan Holbrook specifically for Cincinnati City Hall? And he seems like, well, he's a star.
No.
So did he come for just Ohio things, though? Because he came from Indy, he said.
I'm not going to get into that either. Okay. I'll let Ken answer that if he wants to answer that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this, when you became federal prosecutor, and I'm just trying to remember the timeline, the investigation into Sittenfeld and some of these other folks at City Hall had already began, and you were just kind of picking it up and keeping it going, right? Like because going back to that, the goal has been to root out corruption.
Yeah, that's fair to say. So Ben Glassman was U.S. attorney at the time, and when it was clear that I was coming in, you know, I started getting read in on these things because I was, of course, in the USA at the time, kind of like Ken Parker is now and Ben before. So that's the luxury of being in that office. So I was already in the office and, you know, met with Emily Gladfelter and Matt Singer and the teams and the FBI as well. It kind of just got me up to speed. But yeah, I think it's very fair to say that Ben and I were completely on the same page as this. And so was V. Paul Patel and Ken Parker. And I don't think there's been a U.S. attorney, at least in the past 10 years, that wouldn't have done exactly what we did.
Was there anything that came out that surprised you?
In the trial?
Yes.
You know, not really. I don't think so.
A lot of things surprised me.
Well, so there's a big difference between, and you'll know this, being in the courtroom and seeing it. Of course, it's a federal case. So you have to, there's no cameras in there. But being in a courtroom and seeing what's going on, seeing how people, not just the people on the witness stand, but how the defendant reacts, the witnesses react, the jurors, the judge, the audience. You know, that's a huge part of any trial. And of course, the jurors see all of that. You know, and so it's a big difference than just kind of reading it.
Do you think that there should be cameras in federal court? I mean, it's such a debate. I came down both ways. Like on one hand, I was able to just concentrate and not use like 10 forms of media at one time. And really, I felt like I could crystallize things much better as I was trying to do my particular job. But the flip side of that is I'm then trying to explain the tone that we were hearing, the things that we were seeing, and trying to explain that, I don't feel like came through like it really needed to. Like, I don't think I really showed people in my stories as much as I tried what the jury was seeing. Plus, it was so much of like every minute. So do you think cameras should be, there should be some rule changes? It's 2022, or do the old rules really?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have a real strong opinion of the, anyway, on the issue. The one I did a lot of organized crime, gang murders stuff, and a lot of our witnesses and confidential informants and just, you know, people that are terrified, I just hate to see them, you know, on camera, knowing that, you know, they have got to go back out in the street someday or even right away and have to deal with, you know, perhaps colleagues of the person being prosecuted. So, but there are ways around that. You know, the state court does it. The state court has, you know, protection. So I don't see a big draw negative for filming, allowing cameras into the federal courthouse.
Do you think it would be beneficial to the public in any way?
Yeah, I think anytime we talk about transparency, it's beneficial.
Do you, you know, there's always donors who have business before governments, who are donors, and on kind of the campaign finance side, the campaigning side of things, do things need to change in order to you know, avoid what's happening, or is it just squarely on each individual person here that's been charged, and it's on them to figure it out and to use better judgment or get better training or whatever that is?
Well, I'll get on my soapbox against 501c4. So PACs and super PACs, they have to declare that the person that's donating money to them and the amount. These 501c4s, which isn't subject to the Sittenfeld prosecution, but right. You know, they don't ever, you know, they can just stay hidden.
Those are what we call kind of dark money for folks who don't.
They're the dark money ones. Yes. And I get the argument for them. You know, I get that argument, but I think it's outweighed by the importance of being able to be transparent with the public on where money is coming from. You know, even the PACs and super PACs, you're going to know who donates to them. And I forget the reporting requirements, how often, but often, you know, sometimes it comes in, you know, after an election, the requirements, depending on the timing of when the donation took place and when they're supposed to announce it. And I don't know how often they're supposed to publicize their donor list, but at least, you know, right. At least the people the people in the news can kind of dig into that. Prosecutors and investigators kind of dig into that if they want to look for possible corruption issues. But with the C4s, nope, can't do it. And I think that's the biggest problem.
Hmm. Do you think that PG should, what should happen to all the money in, now that he's convicted, in PG's PAC?
Well, no, I don't know what the government's going to ask for. I don't know what they're, but as far as fines are another issue. I don't know the PAC itself. I don't think that was indicted, but the 40,000, yeah, that would revert back as restitution or that would be, I would imagine that would be seized and forfeited.
What do you think about the idea that they tried to make? And you know what? This argument did not go anywhere at trial. They tried to make hay that this was a very expensive investigation. I'm like, go ahead, detail that trip. But they tried to tentatively go down that path. Thoughts on that?
Well, whenever you're doing something like that where there's a sting operation, that's always a concern. You know, whether a jury appeal, whether it's right, whether you have entrapment issues, you know, so there's a balance there, right? I don't believe there was an entrapment defense in this case, but it's something that the jurors always kind of look at and see. So we need to be aware of that when we're investigating and prosecuting cases. We need to be able to justify, you know, the money spent on these sort of cases. And as you're aware that, you know, Mr. Sittenfeld was just one individual that was kind of caught up in the undercover sort of operation that was going on. So that, you know, that's something that operational security, you know, requires people to do things and act like they're doing things that aren't good, that aren't proper, that are often illegal.
Did you, we've obviously seen who's made the news and who's been charged, but did you investigate anyone else while you were where you were in office?
It's like every 10 minutes we ask you that question.
I think you said that with a straight face until, you know, I started giggling, but yeah, we can't talk about that, of course.
Do you think
I just had to make you say that.
Do you think that we could see more things coming? I mean, speaking of winks and nods, like Attorney Parker did say, well, you know, no comment about seeing more things.
With a smile.
With a smile.
That's up to Ken. You know, that's his burden now. I don't have to worry about that stuff.
Hey, you worked you worked for many years with Ken, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah. What do you think of him?
Oh, he's great. Yeah. I was very pleased that he was nominated. Good man, knows what he's doing. Trusted, well liked, hard worker. You know, he's the guy that, you know, you get the emails from at, you know, 2:30 in the morning. Just, you know, great guy, and he'll do fantastic.
He is locked in on this public corruption thing.
I don't doubt it one bit.
Yeah.
Tell us what you're doing now.
So I'm with a national firm called Barnes & Thornburg, and I'm in Columbus mostly, but I do a lot of kind of white-collar investigations of institutions, and I do some civil litigation. I'm teaching. I teach adjunct at Ohio State Law, doing some guest lecturing. I am the technical advisor for a show called Bellions, which is on Showtime, which is fun. I really enjoy that.
Wait, what is the show called?
It's called Billions.
Oh, I know what that is. Okay. Yeah. And how long have you been doing that?
Just for about 6 months.
What does that entail?
So what I do is I work with the writers. You know, they come up with scenarios. I have an NDA, so I can't get into the nitty-gritty of it. But, you know, they have, like, you know, they'll say, hey, look, how would, you know, this prosecutor go about doing this? Or how would this bad guy go about doing this? And kind of inner workings of DOJ, the courthouse, courtrooms, things of that nature. So we just kind of go over scenarios with the writers. It's fun.
Intriguing. You've gone Hollywood on us. All right, then. I can't. They picked the right person.
Do you miss, you were obviously early in your career, you were in the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office many, many years. You were in the federal prosecutor's office before you got the ultimate appointment from the Trump administration. Do you? I mean, you are a prosecutor through and through. Do you miss doing that?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
definitely. I actually have a couple special prosecution gigs I'm doing, and you know I love it. So yeah, I enjoy being in the courtroom. I enjoy, you know, prosecuting cases, investigating cases, and you know maybe someday I'll get back to doing it. But for now. You know, I like it here at Barnes & Thornburg. They're great, and it is interesting work.
Here's one thing that I, you know, just so much appreciate about you, about Ken Parker, and I, you probably look across the country and probably say that about most or all of the federal prosecutors, is that no matter who appoints you, I think you came in as an assistant federal prosecutor, under George W. Bush, I believe. You worked through the Obama years. You know, Ben Glassman was an Obama appointee to the federal prosecutor seat. But it doesn't, you see that politics, the political leaning of someone has not mattered in these public corruption cases. You know, Larry Householder, a Republican, P.G. Sittenfeld, a Democrat, Jeff Passer, Republican, Tamayo Dennard, a Democrat. Is that pretty easy to remove political leanings as you go about this work?
In the Southern District of Ohio, definitely. Yeah, I don't even know who's what. Like, I don't have a clue.
Yeah.
Like, who is a Republican or a Democrat in my office, or very, very few people. Like, I guess that's a lie. Some people I could tell just from, you know, having a beer with them. But for the most part, you know, I don't. You don't get the Hatch Act's a great thing. You know, the Hatch Act doesn't allow us to get involved in politics. And I think it just the culture of my office, it just, you don't talk about it.
But it also, like, it doesn't make for you know, sacred cows, so to speak. Like, you know, Ken Parker, he was appointed, you know, he was appointed by the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. He's not sitting there, oh, I'm not going to go after Democrats, or I'm only going to go after Republicans. You weren't sitting there saying, I'm only going to go after Democrats and not Republicans. Like, there's none of that.
It's not even thought about.
Yeah.
It's never even considered. That's the good thing. It crossed my mind to think that way when I was an AUSA or U.S. attorney, and it never crossed my mind where I was suspicious of anyone else, whether they were, you know, Ben Glassman or Carter Stewart or anybody else thinking that way.
The law was nonpartisan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you felt that in the courtroom with the judge, too. You just didn't feel that there were politics in that courtroom at all. This was a case about, well, bribery and attempted extortion.
Yeah.
Judge Cole is great, you know, and Judge McFarland is also pointed down there that I have the utmost confidence in them. They are not going to be swayed by politics or anything else. I'm certain of that.
I'm sure you'll be watching the householder trial. I guess that's probably going to come up right after the turn of the year. You'll be watching that one closely as well.
January 21st.
Yeah, I will likely be watching that one, yes.
He has nothing else to say about it.
No.
It's that another 10-minute mark where we're like, oh, here, we'll have to ask about a specific.
Sherry, you anything else you want to ask Prosecutor DeVillers?
You know, were you just surprised? Let's go back. Like, not at the trial. Okay, so you weren't surprised. That was a bad question. And what was happening at trial? Of course you knew it was happening. I did not. Were you surprised back when you were hearing things and getting reports at how bold it was in the idea that somebody could think they were dealing with the mafia?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you heard what I heard, and you know, not just that case, but other cases too. What you hear from witnesses and on tapes, yeah, that was the biggest thing coming into becoming U.S. attorney and kind of getting read in on things. And it wasn't the murders and the terrorism and the cartels. It was the corruption. That was the biggest surprise for me. Hmm.
Yeah. Well, you know, thanks so much for joining us here today. And, you know, thanks for what you do. And you know, what you did is that your service to the public as a prosecutor, and you're on with your life and doing great things in the private sector. And always enjoy following you on Twitter and appreciate you joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, guys.
All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
No problem. Have a good day.
All right. Thanks again to Dave DeVillers. Appreciate his insight and joining us. And obviously, you know, can't answer some questions, but we knew that going in, but still have to ask the questions. And, you know, much respect for him and what he has done in his career. Sherry, that shifts us into our That's So Cincinnati moment of the week. And
I don't think it was inside the federal courthouse. I'm just guessing, though.
No, it was not. It is our executive editor, Burl Love's favorite segment of this podcast. And so in honor of him, he and I went to Price Hill Chili last
week.
He took me and, it was his first time to
Whose
Price Hill Chili.
Was it? Was it your choice or his?
It was Burl's choice.
Okay.
Burl's choice. Burl called it. He wanted to go to Price Hill Chili. His first trip, he got a three-way. He got to talk with his fellow. He had to have some Greek time, Greek brother love time with Steve Belsos, the owner of Price Hill Chili.
I'm surprised they don't know each other.
They know the family. Okay. The families know.
Well,
yeah.
Well, that's
yeah.
Right.
So
what'd you have?
Had my usual chili cheese geta omelet with chili and feta on top.
Say that again.
Chili cheese and geta omelet.
Okay.
With
I don't know them.
Also
this.
With chili and feta on top.
Okay.
And Burl asks, like, I didn't know you could get that, and or that's on the menu, and
He should come over to the West Side more.
Steph, the server, said, I put it on the menu, or I made it up, so. Burl says he liked the chili. It's a unique, it's a different tasting chili than anywhere else, although I think that they all taste different. And
I mean, it's also about the people there. Like, you know, you see everyone you know, everyone's so nice. Like, there's also that's two-pronged, good food and the people there.
So our That's Just Insane moment of the week is Burl Love got Price Hill Chili for the first time. Price Hill Chili, which has made many, many, many appearances on this podcast.
That's true. With you. He had it with you, too. Intriguing.
It was a special moment.
All right.
It was a That's So Cincinnati moment. Anyway, Sherry, great job covering the trial. Appreciate your coverage. We'll look forward to obviously more of what you're as you kind of go ahead toward the sentencing. There's so many stories, so many questions still sort of looking ahead on this, you know, City Hall, the culture of corruption. That is, you know, as Dave DeVillers coined it at City Hall, is it a new day at City Hall? You know, there's just so many things to kind of look toward here. We'll look forward to your coverage on Cincinnati.com and The Inquirer. And as always, we appreciate Silent Phil and the ones and twos. Catch you next week.